Dr. Helene Gale is no stranger to leading during a crisis. Prior to leading Spelman College, Dr. Gale spent her career in leadership roles in the government, the nonprofit space, and the private sector. And to top it off, she's been named one of the 100 most powerful women by Forbes. Throughout her successful career, she's remained grounded in her purpose and her mission. At the heart of her decisions is the notion that people are policy. I'm your host, Kathleen McGinnis, and this is Smart Women, Smart Power.
This is Smart Women, Smart Power, a podcast that features conversations with some of the world's most powerful women.
Dr. Gale, we're so honored to be sitting with you here today. You've had the career of a lifetime. You've impacted so many, and you're leading an incredible academic institution. Is all the work you do just... You lead and inspire, so we're very grateful for your time here.
Thank you.
I'd love to start our conversation with your origin story. What got you into this field? What prompted you to answer the call to service?
Yeah, well, thanks. It is wonderful to be here with you, and always a pleasure to do things with and for CSIS. I'm a proud, longstanding board member and collaborator.
For which we are so grateful.
Yeah, so many ways in which I owe so much to CSIS. So it's great to be here. So, you know, I guess most people's origin stories start with family, community, and the things that kind of helped to shape us, who we are. And I would say probably two big things in my life. First of all, my family.
Yeah.
I come from a family that felt that education, getting a good education, was incredibly important. And so I'm a middle of five children who have all had higher education and graduate degrees and all the rest. But we were also taught to use our education to be able to give back and make a difference. So that was very much a part of what was instilled in all of us in childhood. I also think that, you know, we also are always a product of our times. I grew up in the 60s and, you know, during a time of real social change in our country, whether it's the civil rights movement, women's movement, liberation struggles for countries around the world that had been colonialized. And so all of those things had a real impact on me. And, you know, I guess I got this sense of the social change bug and wanting to be part of something bigger than myself. And so, you know, I wanted a career and tools that I could use to be able to make an impact, a positive impact, help to create positive social change. And that's what I think I've been able to dedicate my life to.
Well, from your vantage point, as a CSIS board member, as the leader of Spelman, your role at CARE, and all the other positions you've held, you've been in this place and this space of having to help organizations think to and respond to crises. And so in DC now, we've got this notion of polycrisis. Well, I guess it's not just in DC.
It's all
in the world, right? And so this notion that we have to have the ability to respond to multiple simultaneous crises at once. And so I guess to start, I'd be very curious to you, like, how do you buy that thesis that we have to be able to manage polycrises? Do you see the world a bit differently?
No, definitely. I mean, we are, you know, just by definition, we're a complicated world. Human beings are complicated. You know, there are all sorts of root causes that lead to a multiplicity of issues. And so I think, you know, we are always going to be struggling with more than one crisis at a time. And I think, you know, that's why it's so important for us to be able to think at multiple dimensions, find problems with multiple sectors, and be able to think in complex ways, because we aren't just there is no one simplistic issue. Everybody, oftentimes people have their one issue that they're passionate about. But, you know, we're so interconnected as a society. Our problems are interconnected. And by definition, we're going to always have this kind of multiple crises or poly crises that we will need to face and prepare ourselves to do that perhaps more adequately than we are doing now.
Well, you're sorry, we have the singular issue focus in so many sectors, but we also we want to solve things with like this one weird trick.
Exactly. We think about magic bullets, and there really aren't magic bullets. There are complicated problems with complicated solutions.
So as you look at the international strategic environment, of the different challenges that are before us, what are the top two or three that are dominating your thinking and how we need to be responding to them?
Well, I kind of try to think about the things that perhaps have a broad impact and multiple impacts. So, for instance, you know, the threat to democracy that I think we're seeing around the world and seeing people wondering. I mean, here in our own country, you know, many people wonder, does it matter if we have a democracy? You know, and I think that that challenges so many other things because it challenges how we problem solve, how we come together as nations, as communities. So, you know, for me, I think that's a huge one. I think the inequities that we face around the world, again, big problem as we see societies, and part of what even fuels some of the lack of faith in democracy are the fact that people's lives are being tested in so many ways, and the inequities that we see, economic inequities, health inequities, social inequities, all of those things that make people wonder, does it really matter if, because it doesn't seem like my voice matters anyway. So does this grand notion of democracy make a difference? You know, I think there are also other big things. You know, we all know that, climate change is a major threat to you know, our survival as a planet and as a species. And, you know, so, you know, I think there are big challenges like that. But when you look at any of those, some of the ones that I've mentioned, they are fueling many of the other ones that we see that are very linked to those.
And also those problems that you just mentioned are also sort of interrelated in that you get frustrated with or cynical about democracy and our societal decision making structures when we don't make progress on things like climate change.
And when our lives our lives don't seem like they're mattering, when it seems like the system is rigged against us, when it seems like there aren't answers to our problems, it's hard to have faith in the systems that you know, have gotten us to a certain extent to where we are today.
Well, you have served in these capacities across a variety of different institutions, in a variety of different sectors. I'd be curious to your views on what kinds of institutions we need in the future to be able to grapple with these, you know, classically wicked problems.
Well, you know, I think we need institutions that are really grounded in the needs of its people.
Yeah.
And I think for a while, I think that we have gotten to the point where our institutions are perpetuating themselves for the sake of their own existence. And we've stopped remembering why they were created to begin with. And at the end of the day, I think if we center our institutions around the needs of people, we will start thinking very differently about how our institutions function, what we consider success, and how we come up with the right solutions.
So bring it back to people.
Bring it back to people, bring it back to community, bring it back to real everyday lives. And what are we doing to support people's lives in very real and tangible ways?
Well, to turn to the decision that you brought to for us to discuss today, which is your decision to brand the International Humanitarian Organization CARE as a women's empowerment organization. I think it's probably quite actually dovetails quite nicely with what we just spoke about. I'd love for you to set the scene for us. What was happening at the time, and what convinced you that this shift was needed?
So when I was recruited to lead CARE, and as many people probably know, CARE is the organization that started the notion of care packages right after World War II, and was a consortium of organizations that came together to provide food aid and other emergency aid to Europe, war-torn Europe, and really helped a lot of the rebuilding efforts in Europe after World War II. CARE then went on to provide emergency relief more broadly, and then ultimately became an organization focused on eliminating extreme poverty around the world in Africa, Asia, the Americas, et cetera. And so, you know, when I came to CARE, it was right around the time where it was becoming pretty clear that poverty was hitting women and girls hardest, and that the, you know, old adage, you teach, you educate a girl, you educate a nation, was something that people were really starting to appreciate more, that if you invest in the lives of girls and women, you can have the greatest return on investment, not only for those girls and women, but for their families and for their communities. And if, you know, I'm an epidemiologist, you look at numbers, you go to where the numbers are, women and girls disproportionately impacted by poverty. So it all made sense. But, you know, again, as I mentioned, CARE's roots were not about women's empowerment and had over time, gone from emergency relief to really thinking about long-term sustainable development. If you put those two together, it made sense that a focus on women and girls empowerment. But it is hard when an organization at that time was about 60 years old, had been doing things one way, large donor base, many whom were still part of the CARE post World War II and just beyond generation. And this idea of focusing on girls and women really made a lot of people uncomfortable. And, you know, we were concerned, we're CARE is a nonprofit organization, concerned, will we lose our donor base? Will people think that we've become some radical feminist organization? Will it be alienating to people? Will it resonate in the countries that we work in? Many of the countries where women's access and women's equality was severely lacking. But what we tried to do was to make the simple case, again, that if you go where the numbers are, and if you go where you know the return on investment was greatest, that it doesn't just impact girls and women, but it has this broad impact on boys and men and whole communities. And I think when we made the argument from the basis of the data and from the fact that if our goal was to eliminate extreme poverty and this was the best way to do it, then we had no choice but to go with where we knew we could have the greatest investment. It took time, it took a lot of developing partnerships. But in the end, I think people really realized we weren't saying we were going to change the mission. We weren't saying we were going to upset our way of working. All we were saying is that we were going to do what was in the best interest of our mission and of our values. And I think if you always lead with your mission, lead with your values, people do come along.
Well, and also the argument, which I see resonating across different spaces, which is if you empower women, dudes do well too.
Exactly. And I think that was, you know, for some people, the winning argument was that we weren't saying that we were only for women and girls or that we only cared about women and girls. We were saying that by investing in women and girls, we will have the greatest impact for everybody. And that includes boys and men. And by the way, if we want to have an impact in girls and women, you have to also work with boys and men so that both are coming around together. So, you know, I think in the end, the holistic message really resonated, but it took time to get there.
And the countries in which you worked that have had a, let's say, a challenging record on gender equality or frankly, women's basic health rights, you know. How did you navigate that dynamic? Or was it just a part of did that not resonate as much, or was that not part of
We work closely with men.
Okay.
And I think, you know, by working with men who become evangelists, they're the best ambassadors for, you know. I can think of examples, for instance, working with men around gender-based violence.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we would use men who had in the past themselves been involved with gender-based violence, who would say to other men, now, you know, if your wife does something wrong,
yeah,
and you physically harm her, is she better,
right,
or worse? Does she respond in a positive way or in a negative way? So if what you want is to have positive results,
mm-hmm,
what you're doing to achieve them isn't working.
Mm-hmm.
And by them talking among themselves and being, you know, peer to peer, talking about their experiences, why did they change? What did they see the positive benefits? And I could give, mm-hmm, example after example,
sure,
of situations where by men themselves working with other men, you know, we were able to see some real changes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also when powerful leaders, you know, I can think of some of the male leaders that we worked with who were able to change legislation within their country, change, mm-hmm, practices, because they understood the positive value, the positive, mm-hmm, economic value, the positive social value.
Mm-hmm.
And so they became believers, and then they could make change happen.
Mm-hmm. And also when we think about the intersection of those issues with conflict, right? Men are often the victims of the gender-based violence as well. So it's, again, empowering women, helping, focusing on women's issues actually helps the broader community.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So can I ask, do you feel that your gender as a woman had an impact on this decision and its outcome? And if so, why? If not, why not?
Well, I think that I could speak from a place of authenticity.
Mm-hmm.
I think that always helps when you can speak from a place of authenticity, when you can talk about your own experiences.
Yeah.
And so, yes, I think that my gender helped. I'm sure at some points it may have also hurt. You know, sure, she wants this. She's a woman.
Oh, right. Yeah.
But, for the most part, I think, yes, mm-hmm, it helped.
But also, you know, but you did the analysis, right? You found that,
right,
that this women were this pressure point. And so you may be a representative of the argument, but it was easy for others to get the logic.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And to conclude our conversation, I'd love your views on what is power.
So I'll read a quote, because to me, this is how I became comfortable with the notion of power. Oftentimes power is presented in ways that are unappealing,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. authoritarian, perhaps stereotypically male, mm-hmm. et cetera. But there's a quote that I love from Martin Luther King, who said, "What is needed is a realization that power without love is reckless and abusive, and that love without power is sentimental and anemic. Power at its best is love implementing the demands of justice." And for me, that last sentence, "power at its best is love implementing the demands of justice," says it all.
Dr. Hillingale, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and insights. And thank you for sharing that reflection. That's a powerful reminder of how important people are.
Thank you.